Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. This is Willem Vanderhorst, your host for the show. Thank you very much for tuning in. Thank you for listening. I'm managing to publish this just a little bit earlier than planned. Well, not earlier than planned, but I'm just catching up on being late on my expected schedule of conversations. So there's still a few conversations I've had with people. I'm still catching up. So if ever you're listening to this and we talked in the past few weeks, don't worry, it's coming up. Your episode and the conversation we've had is coming up. Just like Steve had asked me that we're talking with today, I talked with a few weeks ago and that I'm publishing today. So really fantastic conversation with Steve, the planner, Steve Bailey. Steve Bailey is the director of strategy and insights at Creata. Creata is a marketing agency that is specialized in working with licensing tools, particularly on McDonald's Happy Meals, but they work with families, children, marketing. And fantastic conversation about all of Steve's journey into becoming a planner, fascinating stories about his studies, about everything else he's done, about rap and hip hop, about the southeast of the United States, North Carolina, where he spent quite a bit of time, in Atlanta, where he spent some time as well, currently lives in Chicago, and all of his adventures around soccer and the non-league soccer. Documentaries he's done for soccer teams. I mean, lots of really cool stories. Like, Steve is a fantastic character, and we had a fantastic conversation. So I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. Just before we get there, a little bit of housekeeping and promotion. Don't forget, it really makes a difference if you give us a rating and a review, a 5-star rating, if you have a chance on your podcast listening app of choice, Apple Podcasts or whichever one you listen to. If you can spend a bit of time and give us a rating or send me a tweet or post something on the Facebook page or share it with your friends. Just want more people to be listening to the podcast, essentially. If ever you want to get in touch, if you'd like to be on the podcast or if you're interested in being in touch with me for whatever reason, or if you have a project or if you have a question to ask about anything to do with brand or marketing strategy, everything else is on the website. That's at icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out, ice cream for everyone. My Twitter handle is at icvillem, letters I-C-W-I-L-L-E-M. And my email, villem@icecreamforeveryone.net. That's willem@icecreamforeveryone.net. And as I said, just give us a shout, post a review, give us a little bit of an idea what you've been thinking. It encourages me to keep going on the podcast, essentially. If I know that you've enjoyed it, I know that there's people downloading and listening, but it's really nice to get a little bit of a human perspective. And yeah, it just encourages me to keep going with the podcast. So yeah, post something on Twitter or give us a 5-star rating and a review, and I would be extremely grateful. And I think that's about it for now. Yeah, so without further ado, here's the conversation I had with Steve. Hey, Steven, welcome to the show.
Hey, Bill. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Do you go by Steve or Steven usually?
Steve.
Steve. All right, cool. Yeah, welcome. You reached out after one of the episodes I published. So who knew? Actually, people are not only listening, but getting back to me. Because as I usually say in my intros, I hugely appreciate when people do that. It makes a hell of a difference. Let's see. Where do we start? I want to have a conversation with you. You reached out to me about having a conversation, and it looks like you're up to a lot of different interesting things. So let's start with just like overview, quick intro of who you are.
Yeah. So my name's Steve Bailey. I'm a planner. Yeah. Planner by trade and planner by passion. You know, I think with like a lot of planners, it's been in me a lot longer than I knew about, you know, the formalized world of planning. But I've been formally in agencies for about 5 years now and applying planning principles to my previous string of jobs leading up to that, like the previous 8 years or so. So, I've been out here out and about for about 15 years, thinking strategically and hoping to solve problems and being entrepreneurial and looking for interesting stuff.
Good. Well, we're going to be digging into a few of those topics. Actually, first one, this is interesting.
A lot of people in creative advertising marketing agencies, or do our job, have started calling it overwhelmingly strategy rather than planning. And account planning is the traditional name where it comes from. You're still calling it planner. I was wondering what your take on that was. It's sometimes a silly conversation, particularly if you don't work in advertising, but still.
Yeah. So my formal title now is Director of Strategy and Insights. And it's the first time I've had that formal title. I've been in more traditional organizations in the past where my title was account planner, senior account planner. I was introduced to the discipline by reading Truth, Lies, and Advertising in a undergrad comm studies class in like 02 at University of North Carolina at Greensboro. And so that's how I got introduced to it. That's how it came into my world. And I'm a big fan of the original goal of planning, of being the voice of the consumer, of being really close to people and keeping people centered in the process. And to me, that's kind of like what the sub-discipline of strategy that is planning is all about, where strategy is a broader tent. And then you get into like analytics and, you know, all these SEO and pure consumer online behavioral strategy, UX, like all these things are under the big tent of strategy, but they're not necessarily people-centric in the same way and human-centered. And that's where my core expertise is and where I like to play. So that's why I choose planning.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
So, well, let's just go back to the beginning for a bit. So you studied in North Carolina. Is that where you're from? Or?
No, I'm from Massachusetts. Okay. Born and raised in North Central Mass, very small town called Sterling, Massachusetts, which is...
is that close to Boston? I don't really
know. It's about an hour west of Boston. It's a suburb of Worcester, Massachusetts, which is like the second biggest city in New England. It's like 200,000 people an hour west of Boston.
All right, cool. And how was your, I guess, upbringing? What kind of, do you have like brothers, sisters, or...?
I have one sister. She's 2 years older than me. She lives in Singapore. And pretty traditional middle class white upbringing. Both my parents were high school teachers. My dad was a high school librarian, and my mom was a high school guidance counselor, both in the same school at Lumister High School. So education was always important. You know, it was always looked at as the path to success. But success for my family was always a little bit different from how I visualized success. Success for my family has been about stability. You know, my parents are retired teachers with a pension, and they come from that. They're core boomers, you know, born in like 50 and 53 respectively. You know, they value that stability. And stability's never been something that I valued a lot. I've always been more interested in finding out new things, new information, meeting new people, and a little bit more adventurous. And in my younger years, I think that manifested itself in some recklessness as I was figuring out how to balance that inquisitive nature with, you know, the need to have a stable income and a career path. But I found it, and things are working out pretty well now.
Cool.
So,
what kind of, like, if you don't mind sharing, what kind of trouble or any, I don't know, recklessness equates trouble necessarily, but.
Yeah, I wouldn't say trouble. I would just say, like, doing whatever I wanted to do and not worrying about the consequences for myself or others. Not in a dangerous way, but just like, you know, a lot of my early entrepreneurial ventures in trying to manage rappers, you know, put me in a lot of crazy situations and, you know, different types of environments.
So wait, for some of your first ideas of doing business were managing rappers?
Yeah. Okay. So my introduction to marketing, like my marketing hero really is Master P. So I
do not know who that is.
Okay.
I'm so sorry.
That's fine. So I grew up, I was born in 81. I'm a child of the 90s.
Yeah.
And graduated from high school in 99. So I was very much into hip hop, still am. It's always been like kind of the cultural lens through which I see the world. And Master P was a great, and still is, a great entrepreneur. And at the time, he was the biggest independent record mogul in America. And largely, he had like no MTV video play when that was the default model for getting exposure. He really did everything himself, completely independent, signed his own distribution deal with Priority Records and Interscope, and you know, made like 90% off of everything and only had to pay up 10% to the distributor. He really made a lot of deals that are not even possible for music artists today, and became, if not a billionaire, damn close to a billionaire. And at one point was the richest person making money off of hip hop, even more so than Puff Daddy. He was at the top. I think eventually Puff Daddy and definitely Jay-Z's passed him. But I mean, he's been out here in the high hundreds of millions forever, and really stressing business first, marketing first, you know, distribution, owning the supply chain, and proactive. He really stressed in his music about Black business ownership, entrepreneurialism, and applying these principles to his efforts. And so he was always like a role model for me in terms of a visionary, you know, and he kind of laid out the map. And he would, back then, when you could make such margins because people were retailing physical CDs and the margins were so high, he would make these very creative album covers. He really...
I'm wearing the t-shirt, right?
Yeah, I just got this. I bought this for myself for my birthday.
I was going to ask you, you're in the t-shirt. Is that all album covers?
Yeah. Right. So he kind of... This aesthetic is very famous now. He really pioneered, like...
How would you describe it for people listening? Because obviously, if they're not familiar...
Well, Pen and Pixel Graphics is the name of the company out of Houston that spread the Bling Bling visual.
Right.
And the song Bling Bling came from Cash Money, who is another New Orleans-based collective at the same time that No Limit was coming out. Master P was originally from New Orleans as well. And so that's where that whole culture was coming from. But he was so prolific, and he would market his CDs with these huge foldouts, and they would have coming in the date that the next albums were going to be released. And there were so many albums, and he would just leave you wanting to collect all of them. And he did that at scale. And he sold hundreds of millions of copies of records because he was getting that scale. And just, he had people totally addicted to his model. And even smaller groups that were new, first time out, he didn't put a huge budget behind them. But just based on their inclusion on the foldouts, he could get like the third tier groups, he could guarantee them like 250,000 copies. You know, guys were going gold with no promotional budget other than the album cover on the foldout. And so that kind of like guerrilla marketing strategy really appealed to me. And then I started looking more into marketing beyond hip hop and looking at all that. So, you know, that's what made me want to leave Massachusetts and go down south. I wanted to get into that. I ran cross country, and I told people that I was looking down south for a better training environment to run cross country in year round. But the truth is that was just a cover, because I wasn't comfortable telling everybody that I really just want to be Master P. But, you know, I'm 38 now. I can admit that. Like, I just wanted to be Master P.
How old were you at the time?
You know, coming out of high school, like 18.
Okay, got it. Yeah. Right. All right, cool. And so that's awesome. So like, did you start before around 18 to like approach rappers and want to represent them or emulate what Master P was doing from that perspective?
So I started when I was in college, towards the end. I just kind of lived a more normal college life, but I kept failing college algebra. So I never really had the opportunity to pursue internships because I was on a year-round summer school class schedule for every summer except for the summer after my freshman year, so that I could you know, graduate in a reasonable amount of time. I graduated in 4.5 years going year-round. So I never had internships. I never had any work experience while I was there. And as I was getting towards the end of it, I realized I gotta put something into action here. So I started this little side hustle called G-Camp, which was a marketing promotions company for independent artists. And I just marketed it myself and went everywhere I could and drove around Greensboro trying to link up with local artists and, you know, do whatever they needed, whether it was flyers or you know, distribute flyers, street team services, run their records to other radio stations and stuff like that. And I linked up with a couple DJs at the local radio station, and they didn't, I interviewed for an internship and they didn't want me and passed on me for that. And but I landed with a DJ who was making mixtapes at the time, and he fronted me a big box of mixtapes. And I used to sit in my apartment with my roommate and look at all these little cities out in Eastern North Carolina. And they were really interesting to me, like Goldsboro, Kinston, Rocky Mount, Wilson, these type of places. And I was like, nobody's probably bringing mixtapes out there. I'm going to get these boxes. So I got the boxes from the DJ, and I would go out there on the weekend and just go on foot, wear cargo shorts, load up my pockets, and just walk through the malls, walk through the basketball courts, like, you know, with these high quality mixtapes. And I would sell these CDs, and I'd drive up to the drive through at the bank and deposit, you know, hundreds of dollars at a time. And that's how I did it. And I came back, you know, the next Monday or Tuesday to the radio station. And DJs like to make mixtapes, but they don't always have the distribution that if they're not plugged in through wholesalers and stuff like that. So I would come back and I'm like, hey, I got it, you know, pay the plug. And I would come back and have like $800, $1,200 or whatever the DJ's cut is, and I'd pocket the rest, and they'd be happy. Here's another box, you know?
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's great. Fantastic. Thank you. Wow. So many different questions. But I want to just stop and actually take a pause to go just a little bit beforehand.
Yeah.
Because this is a new question. And as I've worked out and looked at what I want to talk about in terms of play, I was wondering, growing up, did you start getting into music early? Or,
yeah.
And associated question, what kind of stuff did you do to play? What kind of games, what kind of play did you do as a kid? Or what were you really into as a child?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was into music really early.
Yeah.
You know, we got cable sometime when I was in the single digits, and MTV.
Yeah.
I would sit down in front of MTV and watch for hours. And I loved hair bands. That was my first love. Before I found hip hop, I used to love hair bands.
When you say hair bands, is that like metal?
That's
rock,
like that light metal, like Poison, yeah, and okay, like, you know, Cinderella, Poison, Britney Fox, like, okay, all these kind of loud, screeching Bullet Boys, kind of like trashy. You know, hair bands has a lot in common with like that era of the amount, just the volume of records that were coming out in the 90s in hip hop, and the origins of the Southern rap scene, which I later, you know, developed into my lifelong passion. But I was into the hair bands and the visuals of it, the bright colors and all that kind of aesthetic, you know.
Awesome.
And sometime around like late 80s, early 90s, I was a little bit into R&B, listening to like Bobby Brown and stuff like that. And then the one thing that just hooked me was The Chronic. You know, when The Chronic came out, Dr. Dre, you know, that changed my life. Like, that's it. That was it. 1993,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
You know, I was in about sixth grade, and that was it. That's where I wanted to go with music. And it brought me, you know, to a lot of different experiences. And I think it brought me through a lot of stages of growth as a person. Probably, you know, I did a lot of dumb stuff. I'm sure there was a lot of cultural appropriation and stuff at various points. But the thing about me is I always just want to know more. So I was able to grow through my ignorance in different times by just being open, asking questions and absorbing and staying in the background when it's my role to stay in the background, learning when it's my turn to learn, and just like putting in the work to read books and just take all my questions further and just use the information that I learned through that journey to internalize it and hopefully make myself a better person. So that's where like my passion for diversity and access and stuff like that, it was all grown through that exposure to hip hop. As far as like outside play, like I'm from the last generation that grew up outside. So I was born in 1981. We played outside. We played in the My backyard was up against some woods. We spent a lot of time in the woods, chasing after each other, beating each other up. You know, a lot of fights, a lot of basketball, a lot of soccer, a lot of, you know, rough touch and tackle football, and riding bikes and skateboards and leaving the house in the morning and coming back at night.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Awesome. Fantastic. And in terms of rap and hip hop, I was wondering, did you write, perform, sing, or rap, or?
Just barely. Like, I realized pretty quickly I wasn't very good at it. It was not my role. You know, I'm a white guy from the suburbs. I got to own that. You know, what is my lane for that? And the only lane for that is maybe like a kind of clever, like battle rap sort of niche, you know, that's probably the lane for people who come from that background, if there
is
one.
Tell me a little bit more about this, because I don't know, and yeah, maybe some people listening won't either.
Right. So, like freestyle competition, like Eminem style,
yes,
stuff,
okay,
you know, super clever little one-liners. That tends to be the best lane for white rappers, or historically was, especially back then.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the type of stuff that I listened to. I wasn't really good at rapping. I just wasn't a good rapper.
Yeah.
And I always never really knew about what the behind the scenes world was like. So I experimented with rapping a little bit just as a way to like find my place in the culture. But as soon as I learned a little bit more, you know, I stopped rapping fairly early.
Right.
I used to ghostwrite a little bit, and I was invited to take part in a student group at North Carolina A&T, which is a collaborative group that pulled students from UNC Greensboro, North Carolina A&T, Bennett College, and all the colleges in Greensboro. And they invited me in because they saw that I had knowledge and a passion, but they didn't really know what to do with me. They knew I wasn't a good rapper, so they just kind of stuck me in the crew. And so I would go to these practices, but I never get a chance to perform. And I learned from the people that organized the group and stuff like that, with things that they were doing in marketing music. And so then I applied that to the Mixtape Hustle, you know, just a couple of years later. So that was like 2000. And then I started getting active like around 2003.
Okay.
So based on the lessons I learned in that environment.
And at university, you were studying marketing and communications?
Or I started out in the business school, but I had so much trouble with the math requirements at the time. Really just lack of focus, and yeah, that I switched to communication studies as a way to keep the dream of advertising alive with less stringent math requirements.
And where did that dream of advertising, where, how did that start? At what point? I mean, I know that the marketing part, that's the dream that you were talking about, right?
Yeah.
Okay, got it. And you mentioned reading Truth, Lies, and Advertising, yeah, which for anybody who doesn't know is one of the big kind of Bibles for strategic planners in advertising, and a great book to read even if you're not in advertising, if you're interested in hearing, learning about it. Like at what point did you come across that book? And did you find out about strategy and planning through that book or beforehand? Or
so I found out about it through that book.
Yeah.
And I think, it's been so long, I think, yeah, that I was assigned that book in a undergrad comm studies class.
Okay.
But it may have been just like a year later when I got the opportunity to go through a couple rounds of interviews for an internship at an agency in Atlanta, which I didn't get. I went two rounds of interviews, drove 5 hours each way from North Carolina to Atlanta, turn and burn, and they said I didn't have enough experience and for an internship. And the recommendation was that I should look into like VCU Brand Center or Miami Ad School.
Yeah.
And I know that I printed off the list at the time of Miami Ad School books they recommended to read for people who are interested in the boot camp. And I just made it a point to read all those books.
Wow.
So I was either from the class or was from that ad school list around that same time.
Okay. And you ended up going to Miami Ad School after.
Yeah. So I thought that, hey, I have these dual passions for hip hop and advertising. Let me try and put them both together, and let me take to heart John Steele's, you know, maxim of be interesting and be interested. So I got a job selling, I needed to get some health insurance. My family was on me, like, you can't just be selling mixtapes forever. Yeah. I did that for about 10 months or so, and I needed a job. So I got a job at Beasley Broadcast Group in Eastern North Carolina selling local radio advertising. So that's what I did. And I sold advertising to like car dealerships and nightclubs and, you know, party promoters who rent out nightclubs and all urban clothing stores and that kind of stuff. So
all local radio.
Local radio, stuff. You know, involving both the hip hop culture and advertising. But I still wasn't getting the looks that I wanted from agencies. So, but at the same time, I was really getting into managing artists. And so I managed a couple artists out there and was moonlighting doing that, probably to the detriment of my advertising sales. But I was just so interested in doing that and buying them ads in rap magazines and like birthing original pieces of creative advertising into existence before I knew how to write a brief or anything, just collaborating with designers who I'd met on that journey through mixtapes and bringing all the these like strands together and trying to facilitate the career of some aspirations of some people out there that I met. So, and one of the guys, the first people that I worked with was a guy who I knew from Greensboro who was from out there and trying to help him get on and help him sell his music. So selling his mixtapes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then I ran to this young lady named Lil Buna, and she kind of became the primary focus because she was just so talented and she had to get out there. And so I just like poured every cent that I had, you know, into trying to facilitate popping her career off.
Does she have a career now in music? Or?
So she got shot and killed outside a nightclub in 2009. So,
wow.
Yeah. So just a crazy stuff out there in Eastern North Carolina. Yeah. So it was after I had gone broke trying to pursue the advertising and I had moved back to Massachusetts. I was managing her out of Massachusetts, working at Clear Channel Radio, selling advertising, but way different. All of the success that I had was built on building relationships with people. And working at Clear Channel was like watching the facts for avails. So there I learned about the formal business of like media planning.
Yeah.
And I learned how to, you know, hand calculate cost per point, cost per thousand, all that sort of thing, meeting targets and getting on avails. And
can you just quickly, briefly describe media planning for the people who might not know how it works?
Yeah. So media planning is, I would really work more with media buyers.
Yeah.
But media planning is the discipline of selecting which media advertising is going to run in.
Yeah.
And media buying is really the mathematical application of that, selecting how to get the most for the target audience and reach the most people at the lowest cost.
So 30 seconds on this particular radio station costs this much.
Right.
A full paid ad in this newspaper magazine costs this much.
Right.
Like that kind of thing.
Right.
You look at, all right, where is the message going to go? What kind of stuff?
And so
what kind
of media buyers would send out avails, meaning they'd say, hey, we have this program coming up. We want you to try and hit this target. They were usually ridiculously low, made it really hard to make a lot of profit. And the percentages that, but there were a lot of them coming through the fax machine. So the percentages on the sale for a salesperson were relatively low. But the hope is that the dollar amounts are high and you build a big book of business that way.
Right.
Or you can get more per sale by going out and finding local direct advertisers. But that was, I still focused more on local direct advertisers, but it wasn't what the Boston market was all about. The Boston market was about building a book of avails. And they wanted me to wear a suit every day and I didn't want to wear a suit. And it just make 100 calls on the phone a day to set up appointments. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to go out and cruise in the car and go drop in on people. And because that's how it worked in North Carolina.
Right.
And I had trouble adapting to that model because I'd been out of that culture for so long. So it just, and I was still managing Buna. And at the end of that run, she was starting to get nominated for like regional awards down south. And she was nominated for a Southern Entertainment Award. and I went to Mississippi. I drove from Massachusetts down to North Carolina, picked her up, drove out to Mississippi, right outside Memphis in like Tunica, Mississippi. There was the award shows were at a casino out there, and came back a day late from that. And they just fired me. They said, "You're not, we don't, this is not a good fit anyway. You know, let's just move on." So I got fired. I started kind of running a scam for like one of the nightclubs that was one of my customers in the Boston area, and led me down to a kind of volatile road. Stopped managing Buna because I couldn't keep putting money into it, and just kind of like ran some party boat cruises off the coast of North Carolina, and really was just trying to find my way. I was pretty lost at that point. Went through some kind of crazy stuff and came out on the other end. One of the people who's that I worked with, I kind of came out of that situation with some like PTSD type of effects, and I really just had to get my life together. And but at the time, I was still getting unemployment insurance out of Clear Channel, and as a way to keep me afloat.
Yeah.
And I realized I got to do something, and I planning was still the goal. Yeah. All that time, I'd been reading those planning books.
Right.
And I said, I'm going to over-educate myself. I'm going to go back to school. I'm going to get an MBA, even though people say it's not necessarily required. I'm going to make sure that nobody can deny me my place. So I got an MBA. I went back. And my goal was to do Miami Ad School too. And after I totally removed myself from the music and all that encompassed it, I went back, sold cars for 3 years.
Let me stop you one second. So can you give us, just because I'm curious also about both the MBA and the Miami Ad School, can you cherry pick a couple of things that you thought were really valuable in either the experience or learning or something else that you got out of it?
Yeah, the MBA was super valuable. And there's a lot of applications of the things that I learned there that have helped me today. And I think the biggest thing that I took from that was taking school seriously. I never really took school seriously all the way through college. Because I thought that I was so smart that I realized that you don't really need good grades. You just need to pass and need the degree. So why bother doing more than that? And to some extent, I still do buy that philosophy, but I think I took it to a little too much of an extreme. And I realized that there were specific skills here that are applicable to the career that I'm trying to get into, and I want to get those skills out of this. Yeah. So by that time, I was like 28, and I knew exactly what I was trying to get out. So I got a tutor. I took the two statistics classes. I went twice a week to two-hour sessions with my tutor and really just gave it everything that I had, and I started getting like B's in math at the MBA level. And I just had to see the practical application of it and to see how this could benefit me as a strategist, having this knowledge. And the same thing, even like required core courses like supply chain management and things like that, I would find the angle that could be applicable to strategy. And, you know, I did a report on like enterprise resource planning and digital tools for ERP and see how that could come from applications of mobile technology and, you know, reading about mobile marketing back in like 2009 when mobile marketing was really in its still infant stages. Yeah. And using my library access as a resource for like reading journals, just informationally, I would go and download all these PDFs of like Middle East and Africa Telecommunications Strategy was one of my favorite journals. And I sometimes would apply it to papers that I wrote for school, but sometimes I'd just like get in there and print them out and get a highlighter. And I'd just be, or like listening to AMA webinars. I used to always go online and listen to the free AMA webinars and take notes and stuff like that. And just like immerse myself in marketing. It was really pure time in my marketing journey.
Wow. That's awesome. It's awesome to hear the passion and hunger for it and like for the amount of work that you put into it. And I think that's probably how you approach most of life, I'm expecting. Fantastic. Cool.
Yeah.
Sorry, I stopped you in the middle of it.
Yeah. I don't want to ramble. So like, I want to get back up to speed. So
that's great. And so you got back up to speed, which led to a break, I think, or how did that, once you finished Miami Brand School?
So I got to
Miami Ad School.
And my goal was to go after I finished the program, but, and to like sell cars for 5 years, but I sold cars for 3. I had met my now wife during that time. She was getting a little antsy. You know, I was getting a little antsy. I'd stabilized myself for a couple years now, and I knew I didn't, that role had served its purpose. It was time to move on. So I applied to Miami Ad School. I moved down to New York. I got a couple odd jobs to get even more money up. A friend of mine from high school that I'd grown up with gave me a job on his landscape construction crew for $12 an hour, and I dug holes for like a couple months to just get some more cash up to go to New York, sublet an apartment for the 3 months, and jumped into the program. After the program, which was amazing, and I was all in on the program, met some amazing people, and that was like my introduction to the real advertising world. I was like, I'm finally in it. 10 years I've been trying to get in it, and now I'm at least involved in it. So
for a lot of people, there's going to be a lot of people listening to this who are trying to get in advertising, whether it's in planning, strategy, or some other discipline, creative, whatever it is, or people trying to get into an artistic career. So what would be, out of all of that experience, your main, what would you say to the people that are trying to get in?
It doesn't have to be, well, it doesn't have to be as hard as it, I probably made it for myself.
Yeah.
I think I took the long, long circuitous route. I would say, if you have a vision, stick with it and just pursue that vision, and don't put so much stock in the kind of maxims that you get from industry luminaries, because I took that John Steele, be interesting and be interested, to so much heart that it probably added like years on to my circuitous journey that I otherwise could have just kind of cut through the middle of, stuck with getting out there and trying to do it. But the big thing is, you can't just fire off, applications through the internet. You have to get those informational interviews and all the things that people, there's a lot more knowledge now than there was back then about, certainly on my individual case, but also just in general in the marketing culture, the students coming out of school now have so much more knowledge than I did. Like that gap has been closed in terms of what's available. So just get out there and do it, get in front of people, and you'll find your way.
Yeah.
You know?
Awesome. Thank you. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Cool. So, let's see. I just want to make sure that we've covered a few things, because I want to change topics,
yes,
but I don't want us to have finished this. So just so people know, then you worked for a few agencies, right?
Yeah. So I'll do the last part of this is, I went down to the Miami Ad School in New York from Massachusetts. I got like a remote freelance job after that for a couple months, freelancing for the Paragraph Project at North Carolina. Dan Carlton, super smart guy. You know, it was just a couple little projects. It was just like a couple $1,000s. But it was like when I got that first check for planning, I remember I was driving like in Massachusetts in Worcester, like I had the check in my hand that had sent me in the mail. And I was like, I'm a planner. Somebody gave me money to do planning. It was like just, I was so overjoyed, and the emotion of that, I can like see it in my head right now. And so I'm on my way, you know? So but it didn't really translate into a full-time job after that. So I was still just like on LinkedIn trying to connect with people, and I connected with this ethnographer named Jenny Karubian, and I didn't really know her from Adam, but she, you know, accepted my outreach attempt, and I talked to her on the phone, and she recommended Smart Revenue, which is like field marketing research.
Okay.
And I started doing these Samsung Galaxy surveys in Massachusetts, like in parking lots for people coming out of stores and intercepts and stuff like that. And that was another little toe in the door. But my big break came when I went to the, I was still looking to get inside the agency, and I went to the Griffin Farley's Search for Beautiful Minds. It was the first year they did it, in 2013. And I went back to New York for that weekend program at BBH. And the people that I met there gave me the confidence to follow through. And I came back from there and I told my wife, my now wife, hey, let's get married and let's go to Atlanta. Because we've been talking about going to Charlotte for a couple years. And but there's not a huge advertising industry in Charlotte. And you know, to go back to North Carolina and all that. And there wasn't going to be enough of enough agencies and enough opportunity to move there without a job in hand.
Right.
I could just get stuck there.
Yeah.
But Atlanta's like similar culture with a lot bigger advertising community. So I said, hey, let's get married. And we got married like in 8 weeks and and moved down to Atlanta and just started doing it. Right before I went to Atlanta, I went to the Stratfest in Nashville.
Okay.
And from there, I reconnected with some of the industry contacts that I got from BBH and people that I met there. And through the referrals that I got from those people, I was able to get interviews for internships. And I sold cars for like 2 weeks in Atlanta. My wife got a job as we moved down there as a dental assistant. She's a dental assistant and retired now. But that led to the internship opportunity at BBDO. And that's when I got in, end of 2013. And from there, I made a good impression, but they didn't have a job for me. I had to kind of pitch for a job and working with new business and planning. And I got the opportunity to go on a new business pitch and represent strategy as an intern. But I was like a 32-year-old intern, so you know, I wasn't a typical intern, but they gave me a lot of opportunities, but there just wasn't any money to fund a position. So I got the job at Matlock, which is an independent, black-owned, multicultural agency specializing in both PR and advertising, and really interesting business model that they have. And it was like a family there, and they took me in and raised me up. And the people that I got to learn from there, Pamela Bishop and Ed Rutland and Kent Matlock, like, just had such a huge impact on me and my life. And they gave me a real good mid-level salary, that's what really, you know, gave me the platform to keep it rolling. And I have to mention Rich Santiago in my time at BBDO the first time too. He was he gave me that opportunity to have that internship and really believed in me. And my time working with Sophia Morales too, who was a junior planner at the time. Now she's like a industry luminary. She works at Facebook. She's like all world everything.
Right.
But the two of us were just out here doing new business pitches, and it was so pure. And we just had the platform to just like go all in and be passionate about new business strategy. And it was so cool working with her and him and stuff like that.
Awesome. Fantastic. So, I mentioned I wanted to change topics, and I'm conscious of time as well. But,
yeah.
You're into soccer. That's a whole other area that I thought we would. I didn't even expect that we'd be talking about hip hop so much.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic, by the way. This is awesome.
You could edit that down.
No. This is perfect. I usually keep everything. But let's talk about soccer for a little bit.
Yeah. So the same, around that time, the low point of like 08, and I was home on the couch. I started watching a lot of Fox Soccer Channel, and I had played soccer as a kid and always like found myself watching national team games whenever they came on TV, but I wasn't I always had soccer knowledge more than maybe the average American, but I wasn't like in the soccer world.
And obviously football for anybody who's not in the States.
Yeah. And so I played as a kid up to like U14 level when I was always fit. I always had good fitness, and I would usually play on the wing and just like outrun everybody the whole game. But I really didn't have much ball skills. And so that led to the cross country transition as a youth. But I came back to the game after watching soccer. I was watching Fox Soccer Channel, and I saw the FA Cup on TV. And I was like, oh shit, what is this? And it was Torquay, and it was this tiny team in like English non-league or League Two or something like that. And they were hosting, I don't even remember, somebody big, I don't even remember who it was, somebody, some brand name club, okay, out at their, you know, 2,000 person ground. And I didn't have all this language I have now, like ground and stuff like that. But I saw this and I was like, this is incredible. What is this? and I found out about what the FA Cup was, and that led me to finding out about the U.S. Open Cup, which is the American version of that. And we have a system.
So it's like a second league? Or
no.
So what's the system? How does it work?
So the system is closed. There's no promotion and relegation. Teams have to buy their way into a franchise to get into the top tier MLS, which is like $150 million buy-in. It's only open to like billionaires. And but the one thing that provides opportunity for all clubs is the U.S. Open Cup, which is like the FA Cup and the domestic cups all around the world, where lower division teams can come in, and if they win through enough rounds, get their shot at teams in tiers above them all the way to the top.
Right.
So my learning about the FA Cup made me search for that, and I found the U.S. Open Cup, and they were looking for people to write articles about these early round qualifying games that were taking place on random fields in the middle of nowhere with nobody watching, but you know they were technically part of the tournament. And so I started writing for this, the cup.us, which is the independent website that covers it. And one thing led to another, and I started writing my own blog and going to games. And that started in 2012. And I tried to go to 100 games in 1 year at all levels. I only went to like 40, but I
still.
Yeah. And so that really, I blogged all the experiences, and I was writing, reading all these like groundhopper blogs and learning about that European groundhopper culture and English groundhopper culture.
Which I don't even know what that is.
Yeah, so this is like people who, lonely guys who travel the country or Europe and try to go to as many different stadiums as possible.
Okay, got it.
And they blog their experiences.
Right.
And they count how many grounds they've been to.
Oh, okay.
So, and some of them are kind of quirky and funny, and they write about their adventures and trying to, you know, find the local pub and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I was like, I started pretty much the first American groundhopper blog.
And from, is that the non-league?
So that was called Deep in the Pyramid.
Okay.
But I wanted, as I got more and more into it, I realized all the politics of soccer and how I wanted to make a change and do something serious and create content. And so I evolved it into a brand called Non-League America. I changed it from that tongue-in-cheek, Deep in the Pyramid name, which was reference to the pyramid structure of promotion and relegation that exists or doesn't exist, exists all the rest of the world but doesn't exist in America, and brought it to a little more serious place. Worked with one of my friends from the soccer community and designed a logo and got out on Twitter and got a website, domain, and had the vision of creating these soccer documentaries. And I had the vision for a long time before I was able to put it all into practice. And I started out just doing like iMovie videos and paying people that I knew. I would buy camcorders, put them in the mail, ship them off to them and pay them, and then have them ship the camcorder and footage back to me. And I would edit an iMovie and throw it up. But then they were really long and unwieldy, and I wanted to tighten it up, so I had fallen in love with this podcast called Church for the Wild, which is like an urban culture podcast, nothing to do with soccer. But the woman who, one of the three co-hosts on there, is a music video director, and I liked her visual aesthetic, and I like, you know, I come from that hip-hop culture, so I reached out to her about doing a documentary about a team that I was interested in, which she had no clue of, but happened to be in her hometown of Wilmington, Delaware. So this is a very low-level supporter-owned club, and I was really interested in supporter ownership.
Okay.
And the politics of fans owning shares in the club.
Was that the main reason you got interested in them in the first place, or
in the club?
In that club, yeah.
In that club, Bear Fight FC.
Yeah.
And so I reached out to Jamisa, and I said, Jamisa, you know, and I used to correspond with her just about the podcast and music and stuff like that. And I said, Jamisa, it's Steve Bailey. I want to shoot a documentary. Can I hire you to do this project? And she has a company, Peace Living Films. And so I went to her city, Wilmington, Delaware, and made this. And she shot this documentary about Bear Fight FC. And it was professionally done. It was that level of credibility that I wanted in the production value that I paid for and invested in, and saw immediately that was the missing link. So I went into this partnership with Jamisa, brought her in, and we started just making more and more movies. And I started flying her around the country and executing all these concepts that I had. And I write creative briefs for it and have briefings with Jamisa and the clients who I pick myself and want to tell their story. And I select, and usually nobody ever turns me down because I'm pretty much paying for everything. And I'm created a little following, and now we got like 6,300 followers on Twitter. I've got a SUV. I wrapped it. It's got a full Non-League America wrap. And we're just out there trying to make something happen. And the goal is to build it up to the point where I'm ready to approach brands to back it. And that's my next step, is I'm going to take all these proof of concept films that I have, professional quality proof of concept films, and start approaching brands. I have a spreadsheet. I have a pitch deck I'm working on, spreadsheet with over 100 different events around the country. So it could be a 365-day-year program. We could have multiple wrap trucks canvassing the country at any given time with teams of strategists and videographers, and just like doing all-out cultural exploration through soccer.
That's awesome. That's very cool. Yeah. And how did you notice in your time getting interested in any kind of change or growth in interest for soccer in the States?
Yeah, especially this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So the lower division amateur non-league scene has, just during the time that I've been involved with this, between 2012 and now, going into 2019, is went from nothing to something pretty big. Detroit City FC is kind of like the poster child of this movement. They were the first team that really started this amateur big fan base club culture. They get like, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 people out for every game that they have in Detroit. And people took notice of that. And it's Buffalo, that area, that whole division of the league that they're in called the NPSL, had some good activity around that time. But now it started in the South, and it's bigger crowds down there. They get like Asheville FC gets 2,000 people a game. Chattanooga gets 5,000 people a game. And even the smaller clubs, they get 500. They get passionate. They're supporters. You know, they're singing. They're just creating their own, bringing their own local culture mixed with copying, you know, things that they see in Europe. And like people start out by copying things they see in Europe and then evolve into finding their own voice and bringing in their local traditions. And all that's happening in real time right now. And that's the kind of thing we're out there covering. Plus all the ethnic teams that have been playing for a long time. We're trying to get people, steer people towards supporting those teams and get those communities out supporting their teams and representation of their communities through soccer and preservation of culture through soccer. That's like the story that's the thread through the Vietnamese soccer in Houston documentary that we made.
Right.
And my tie there is my wife is Vietnamese, so okay. I have some knowledge of the culture and stuff like that. And the Super Delegates documentary that we made about West African immigrants, mostly from Cameroon, and the team that they have in suburban Maryland,
okay,
outside Washington, D.C., and linking these communities to the rest of the world and giving opportunities for players and these communities to have their voices heard.
Wow, that is really, really cool. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we want to connect some big brands with that. And, you know, brands are always looking for cultural authenticity, and it's all there. They just need to get involved. And there's a lot of money floating around and, you know, put up by these communities to put on these big events.
Right.
There's 24 Vietnamese teams from around the country flying into Houston on Memorial Day weekend.
Really?
To host a national Vietnamese tournament. And, you know, thousands of dollars, and local Vietnamese businesses are putting up thousands of dollars in sponsorship. Like, it's all there, ripe for a big brand to come in and say, hey, we want, like, Toyota would be one that, in my mind, should be involved in something like that.
Why Toyota?
Well, because they make Vietnamese language advertising. They run it on the core Vietnamese stations on the DirecTV package domestically. Like, they already have a presence in the community. So I would think that that would be a natural place for them to go, activations. Or soccer brands like Adidas, for example, you know, 24 teams have uniforms, need supplies, you know, with 20 people on each team, 20 times 20 is 400, 400 people out of this tournament that your regional sales rep should be out there talking to, you know, and we can provide access to that and documentary footage of this culture for every community in the United States and let people, and we really play the background. We just work with people to provide the image that they want to portray. And so everything is worked on together and has that lens of authenticity throughout.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. Cool. Well, this is exciting. There's a lot of stuff going on the soccer floor. And I had no idea about the subculture. I mean, I barely know that there's tons of cultures and stuff that I don't know about for sure, but this is a really interesting one. Okay, let's move through because I want to, we can talk for hours, right?
Yeah.
But I want to hear a little bit about what you're up to now work-wise. I mean, you're clearly busy on the soccer front, but you also have your day job, and that was another reason I was interested because the agency that you work for called Creata, works on play and toy licensing, and you do focus groups with children, and so I was really interested in hearing a little bit of an overview about the business, what you do over there, and how that works.
So Creata is a brand ideas and activation business specializing in kids and family marketing.
Yeah, that's the official
positioning.
Official, it's written down in your notebook, reading from
but,
it.
But Creata really is the global Happy Meal agency.
Right.
Okay. So we have 14 offices around the world. We service McDonald's global Happy Meal business.
Got it.
We run strategy for McDonald's Happy Meals. And I'm really on the periphery of that process. We also have a in-house focus group facility. And we do all the, domestically, we do all the focus groups for North America out of our Oakbrook Terrace location. And I moderate those focus groups with kids to see what kind of licenses and brands, shows that the kids are interested in right now. Because it's a long lead time and we have to make sure that the recommendations that we put forth are gonna hit. Because a lot of, like any big corporation, they're gonna play it safe. They're gonna go with things that they know are gonna get some kind of traction, even if it's not huge traction. They'd rather have 80%, 100% chance at hitting 80% favorability than taking a risk and getting people super passionate about something or having it fall flat.
Yeah, particularly if you have a long lead time and you know your thing is going to go out to billions of kids.
Right.
Literally billions
of kids. Billions of kids. And they have agreements, you know, with movie studios and based on theater release dates and support.
I will
for
just
programs.
Stop you just 1 second, like completely doing a shameless plug and stop you in the middle of what you're saying, but also because it's a behind the scenes, it's really interesting. One of my previous episodes with a guy called Jack Ryback, who had old stories, he used to work for Disney, mm-hmm. and he brokered the first deal between Disney and McDonald's for the Happy Meal. So he has stories about what happened behind the scenes at Disney on what happened with the toys and how it was negotiating with McDonald's, et cetera, which was fascinating from recommend going back to that episode where there's like behind the scenes of Disney and McDonald's, which you wouldn't necessarily like, you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't even, that part of the business I'm not as privy to.
Yeah.
I would definitely want to check that out.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's basically, I say all that to say that there's like two or three slots open for new properties to really get a shot.
Yeah.
So that's what we're looking at. When we look at, have kids look at like 50 or 60 properties, they don't all see every one of them. We cycle them through and kids get a chance to give their opinion about these different properties. And we narrow it down to get to the couple that we think are have an opportunity to make it into the Happy Meal and make an impact.
I've never done any focus groups with kids, and I'm about to talk to somebody else who specializes in that in a few days, and I'm looking forward to that conversation. Any you know, highlights or how is it?
You got to meet them where they're at. You know, you got to keep it simple. You always want to, you know, traditionally in focus groups, you always want to get under the surface, ask why, get to deeper insights. But depending on the age of the kid, that may not be possible.
Yeah.
Kids may not be able to articulate, that level of comprehension.
Yeah, so and also not hiding anything most of the time.
So when it comes, exactly. That's very perceptive on your part. They're not. They're just going to tell you what they think.
Yeah.
So the only hard part is getting them to open up initially, but because they might be nervous or shy.
Sure.
But once you get them to open up, they're going to tell you what they think. And it's really just about keeping them focused and moving quickly.
Yeah.
And gauging that initial reaction. When the logo pops up on the screen, what do they first think about it? That's the truth.
Yeah.
And so I'll spend a lot of time going back and looking over the videos just to see initial reaction, and less about what kids say, because there's a lot of groupthink that comes along. The kids want to agree with other kids who spoke before them. But you can see from the initial reaction, somebody who said, yeah, the same thing as he said 2 minutes later, initial reaction might have been kind of stale. And I'll take that initial visual reaction of staleness to be the reality.
Right.
And that's how I look at it. You know, you have to read a lot of nonverbals as opposed to verbals, working with really young kids.
Cool. And last topic, I think it's going to be the last, but strangely enough, we could have started here about where we are. And just before we hit the record button is what we were talking about. Can you tell us where we are right now?
So right now we're at the TruStar Foundation. And TruStar is a really cool program that serves primarily Chicago public schools and provides media and marketing, hands-on media and marketing education, an after-school program to kids in Chicago public schools. And when I was in high school, we had something called DECA, which was very formalized, and you'd go to events and you'd like take tests. But this is not like that. This is for our modern times, for 2019. Kids get a chance to work with technology, get hands-on, develop strategies for other youth entrepreneurs, and apply them to the marketplace. They have a whole host of, you can go and check them out. You can Google TruStar, TruStar.life, TruStar Foundation, and see the kind of things that they're up to. But they're really making a difference in spreading awareness and capabilities of how to move in the world of marketing and advertising to public school, high school kids in Chicago. And this program could be huge. Just, I hope that this program keeps growing. But it provides kids a way around all the barriers that we talked about that I went through. Yeah. And kids who, and I didn't face structurally all the barriers that these kids face. I didn't have all the troubled home life or you know, a lot going on. And, you know, some do, some don't, but every kid is different. But, you know, these are Chicago City kids that are getting exposure to office level applications of marketing strategies. And it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And because it doesn't have to be as late in the process as most of the current. There's so many great programs out there, and this is not a knock against them, but a lot of them by their nature are pretty self-selecting. Things like MAPE, things like Ad Color, a lot of the industry multicultural diversity initiatives, which are huge, still like tend to pick kids out of, okay, I'm a minority student. I found my way to the University of Texas at Austin, UT, advertising grad program, you know, either undergrad program. And from there, I got involved in student advertising competitions, or, you know, there's a lot of like self-selection through that process. And these are a lot of the people that I've met over the course of the last several years, young people coming into the industry. But not everybody knows about that stuff. How many people are lost in the process that don't get a chance to even get to those programs? This is a program that captures anybody in the Chicago, has a potential to capture anybody in the Chicago public school system with interest in marketing and entrepreneurship, and get them involved. And they actually place an intern, they have a agreement with Leo Burnett, where they place a TruStar high school intern inside Leo Burnett at all times. They have like a rotating internship program there.
It's very cool.
Amazing.
That's awesome.
So that takes all these barriers out.
Yeah.
You know? And that's the kind of democratization of access that I'd like to see in the advertising industry. That's the next level, you know? And so when I found out about this program, I went to their fundraiser last year at Leo Burnett. I was just thinking to myself, how can I get involved? So I followed up and have been teaching strategy to kids in the program here the last couple months.
Awesome, cool. All right, let's move on, and we're gonna complete with the kind of cool down questions that I have. that are sort of rapid fire ones, and we're finished there. The easy to start with and kind of get into it is, do you have a favorite ice cream flavor?
Well, yeah, I just, I'm partial to the sweet ones. I have like a kid at heart when it comes to ice cream. I just, my birthday was Tuesday, and I got cookies and cream.
Very good. Yeah. I love cookies and
but
cream.
But I also kind of like cotton candy confetti. That's another one.
Ooh, I don't think I've ever had that.
That's really sweet, like kid flavor.
That sounds very sweet.
Yeah. One of those two.
Well, we talked about sports, but is there a game that you enjoy and recommend playing? It could be, soccer or something else.
Yeah, I was playing a lot of rec soccer in Atlanta. I haven't been playing
Is
so
rec
much.
Soccer the indoor kind? Or
no, like no. I just mean like recreational okay, soccer, so, like co-ed 7-on-7 outdoor,
okay.
Short field
yeah.
soccer. I was playing on a couple teams in Atlanta. I haven't found a team here in Chicago, but when the opportunity strikes, I'll play soccer. But like pure play, I like to just, I play with my kids. I got three kids that are all in that innocent play stage. So my oldest is about to turn 5. I got a 3-year-old, and I got about to be 1 tomorrow, all girls.
Wow.
So just getting down on the floor and playing with them is really gratifying. So I play a lot of Barbies.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Awesome. I was going to ask, and this is a new question that I'm testing out, and it's great that you got your little notebook here. I was going to ask, how do you usually take notes, or do you usually take notes, and how?
Moleskin. I got all these Moleskins dating back to Miami Ad School that I keep. And it's funny, my Moleskins keep getting smaller and smaller. I started with like a big, you know, 8.5 by 11 book before I knew what I was doing. And I like the Moleskin unlined, preferably soft cover. That's like the goal. You can, or secondarily would be like the graft. Third would be the lined, but I have like a criteria that I evaluate them and I work back from what's possible. This is unlined hardcover, which is like 2 out of 3, but yeah, that's how I take notes.
Did you both take notes and consult them often as well, or do you go back to your notes?
Oh, I go back to my notes all the time.
Okay.
I keep these books. I go back and try to find connections and things from the past. Where especially like if I'm working on an account and I see that something I've worked on in the past could be applicable or a way of thinking about a problem, then I'll go back and consult my notebooks from the time when I was working on those different brands and see if there's like a thread that I can better articulate from the old notes of the time when I was really in it, living it, than trying to like rack my brain for the words that may not be popping up to the front.
Awesome. All right, what's the last piece of art or media that had an impact on you?
I watched this documentary on Netflix. I've watched a few things since then, but the last thing that really had an impact was, it's called like The Boy Who Caught the Wind.
I saw the trailer and I haven't watched it yet. I added it to my list.
Yeah, it's about a kid in Malawi who built a windmill like from scratch, and his parents couldn't pay the school fees, but he kept at it. He knew that he wanted to do it, and he built this and created the irrigation system for his community and went out from there to college and is doing big things around the world now. But that was his story is in this movie, and it's not a documentary, but it's a theatrical retelling of his experience based on a true story. Amazing.
Awesome. The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. All right, last one. If you could give one thing to everyone, like you just make a wish and everyone has it, what might that be?
Acceptance of differences.
Thank you.
Embracing differences. Not only acceptance, but like embracing the beautiful world, diverse world that we live in, you know? It's such an opportunity to connect with all these different people. I don't know why you would shut yourself off from all the different gifts that people have to share.
Awesome. That's a fantastic way to end. So where can people find you, find the Nonly website, just to make sure that we've got all the links out?
Yep.
And then we need to free up the room for the high schoolers so they can come and do their program.
Yeah, nonleagueamerica.com.
Okay. And obviously I'll put all the links in the show notes. All right, cool.
But at NonLeagueUSA on Twitter, that's where we're the most active. The website, you know, we post the videos there too. There's a couple things that are on there in the archive that, you know, you have trouble finding on Twitter. But if you really want to be up with what we're doing day to day, at NonLeagueUSA on Twitter. you know, you can search Non-League America on YouTube. That's where we house our mini documentaries. So check that out. Creata.com for Creata. You know, would love to talk to you about family marketing and play and everything that's going on in the world of kids these days. So Creata.com, formerly, you can find me on LinkedIn, Stephen with a V, Bailey with a Y, Stevenbayley. I'm not hard to find. At Steve the Planner on no E in the second planner, PLANNR, Steve the Planner, at Steve the Planner on Twitter. I'm out here.
All right, cool. Fantastic. It was an absolute pleasure chatting with you, Stephen. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, that's another wrap on another episode. Thank you very much for listening up to now. And as I said at the beginning, if ever you've enjoyed the episode, please share it with friends. Just hit that share button, get a few more people to listen to the podcast. Give us a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or on Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts. Or just give us a shout on Twitter at Icy Villam. Sorry, not Icy, although I do ski. Not at the moment, it's springtime. But I will hope to be getting it for the winter on a completely different topic. I seem to be rambling already. So I will tell you, thank you very much again for listening. Good afternoon, morning, night, whatever time of day or night it is for you. Thanks. Bye.